We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome back to Palisades Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Lawrence Lepard from Equity Management Associates. How are you today, Larry?
I'm good, Tom. How are you? Thanks for including me in your show.
Of course. It's always great to have you and to speak with you. But, you know, I like having you on around to review each of your quarterly letters. So In your latest one, it states that we are in the early to middle stages of a worldwide sovereign debt bubble collapse. So if we were to take the U.S. as an example, with U.S. sovereign debt currently exceeding 130% of GDP, what would have to be the case for this bubble not to collapse and to be able to somehow avoid the outcome of the situation?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom. And it's you know, been, I'm going off of history now because, you know, we haven't had one of these things in any of our lifetimes, as I talk about in the letter. And, you know, there's really kind of no completely avoiding it, but there are different paths that you can follow. One path is it collapses like 1929, where, you know, the bubble that's in everything today kind of bursts and, you know, all prices collapse, you know, activity collapse, economic activity collapses, debts go bad, et cetera. So that's the extreme depression outcome, which generally is how, historically, is how many debts have been taken care of. The second one, or, you know, the more likely one in my view, is that, you know, we, the government, the people who control the money supply and run the system, do their best to generate enough inflation and that they're able to grow the GDP at a rate which makes the GDP become less compared to the debt. But they're kind of trapped because really growing GDP involves taking on more debt, because what they're assuming and trying to execute that strategy is that they'll be able to keep the bond market, you know, stable and people won't be selling bonds. And the time when that occurred, the last time when that occurred was post-World War II. We had the same kind of level of debt after World War II because obviously it was an existential threat. And, you know, they told people to buy war bonds and everybody saved their money and there was rationing and so on and so forth, which prevented inflation from being bad at the time in the early part of the war. And they were able to, basically coming out of the war, have the same level of debt as we have today, but through yield curve control, they told the bond market, hey, we're going to keep these rates at a certain level. And surprisingly, the bond market didn't revolt. It might have been because we were on a gold standard at the time, or a semi-gold standard, I should say. You know, owning coins had been outlawed, but at least the dollar was backed by gold. And so, you know, they created a lot of inflation, and bondholders got killed on a real basis from World War II all the way through really pretty much to the end of the 70s. And, you know, the relative level of debt that the war had created became manageable compared to the size of the GDP. And I think they're going to try and run that same playbook this time around. And whether they're successful or not is to be determined. I think the bond market has a lot to say about how they, whether they succeed or fail. And I also think that, you know, the system is a lot different than it was back then. People were much more complacent and willing to kind of, you know, do the right patriotic thing, which was to buy war bonds and hold debts and, you know, believe in your country. And I think that thought pattern is not quite as embedded today in the United States. So we'll see. I mean, these typically bubbles like this end badly. And, you know, the only way to, everyone wishes there was some easy way out. I do too. It'd be great, but there isn't. I mean, it's, you know, it's like doing heroin, right? I mean, you gotta crash, you know, or else ultimately you're gonna die if you don't crash, and then you gotta crash and go through rehab to, you know, get back to being sober. And that's kind of the right analogy as I see it. It's very unfortunate. I mean, we're all gonna suffer. But the positive of it all that I always try to emphasize is that, you know, a lot of the ills in society today, if you look around, you see them. They should be fixed, you know, post-suffering. In other words, the suffering is going to lead people to go, wow, that was really stupid. Why did we ever think we could have a bunch of people sitting around setting interest rates? You know, I mean, it's like setting the price of grain in the Soviet Union. I mean, you know, so a lot of things are going to break and collapse. But, you know, I submit that collective conscience is not entirely stupid and will take steps. People will arise and take steps to set up a system that is a much better system than the one in the past. Of course, this is the fourth turning that everyone talks about. And that under that new system, you know, our kids and their kids will thrive. And there'll be some other crisis, you know, years and years in the future, but you and I won't be here. And more importantly, you know, we will get it fixed. I mean, this, as long as we don't go into a shooting war, which, you know, is what happened in the World War II, you know, the last debt collapse in the 30s in World War II, last fourth turning, I should say, as long as we don't get into a shooting war, you know, all the people are still here, all the facilities are still here. You know, it's just, what's really going to happen is just the wealth is going to change hands. From, you know, those who are holding paper claims to those who hold real stuff. And, you know, it's pretty obvious to me. And it's, you know, what's not obvious to me or to any of your listeners, I'm sure, is exactly how it's going to unfold and exactly the rate at which it's going to unfold. That's very hard to assess. But, you know, the fact that it is headed in that direction pretty clearly, I don't lack any confidence in that. So.
Interesting points there, Larry. So tell us about how price fixing in theory sounds like a great idea. However, in practice ends up turning incentives on their head, and how this also applies to the interest rates right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, markets are a beautiful thing, right? I mean, they match supply with demand. And so, you know, price goes up, price goes down, but, you know, businessmen and people make adjustments to, if the price is high and the profit's there, people will add capacity. And if the price is low and there's no profit there, they'll remove capacity. And, you know, you can see this in the price of oil. I mean, you know, because there was no stores, the price of oil went negative briefly, you know, last year, which was kind of shocking. And, you know, the price mechanism is what makes capitalism work and which makes economies work. You have tons of examples of when you suppress the price mechanism or you know, some government body sets the price mechanism, you know, either the price is too low, in which case people won't produce and there won't be any. And so there becomes a black market for something, or, you know, the price is, you know, is too high and, you know, you get the opposite. You get, you know, tons and tons of stuff produced, but eventually that price collapses because there's excess supply and there's no demand. So, you know, so the interest rate obviously is the price of money, right? And the theory says, and it's correct, that, you know, the people save money in order to earn a return on it, and people borrow money in order to invest it in a way that they will produce a return on that. And that's really the essence of borrowing and lending. And that's what it should be used for. You know, people should borrow money to put into projects that will generate returns in excess of the cost of borrowing. And in turn, people who have capital should lend it to people that they think can give them a return in excess of holding cash and adjusted for the risk they're taking on the projects. And by holding the rates of interest extremely low for many, many years, the central banks have created excess capacity in nearly everything and have created an enormous debt structure. And now that, you know, the COVID thing came along and you know, created a real shock in demand. And as a result, you know, a lot of things would have collapsed had the government not taken the actions it had to take in March, on March 23rd last year. So, you know, so what they're doing is, I mean, it's like, they're like an alcoholic who, you know, rather than sobering up is saying, well, let's have another drink and let's just try and create some more debt. Let's try and push more money into the system, et cetera, et cetera. And it becomes, there's several laws that describe this, but, you know, one of them is kind of, you have to accelerate the rate of appreciation of printing and of creation of the money supply, because, you know, as the bubble gets bigger and bigger, it's hungrier, and there are more things that need, you know, there are more debts that need to be serviced, and the system is not servicing them already. And so as those debts grow even larger, the money printed has to grow even larger. And that's what we see. I mean, I heard a statistic the other day, I'm sure you have too. I think 40% of all the money created since the beginning of time was created in the last 6 or 7 months. So, you know, it's kind of nuts, right? And by the way, and anyone who thinks that's going to slow down, I mean, it could slow down, but if it did slow down, you know, the economy would collapse. And, you know, you see this where, you know, you had the IOER spike, or you had the spike in the repo market, you know, this is all pre-COVID. But then of course COVID came along and that created a real shock in the demand side. And so, you know, they had to print like crazy there. And now, you know, we're beginning to see the implications of that printing, which I talked about in my letter, which is, you know, the price of everything is going berserk. I mean, it's just going bananas, right? And some of that's the supply shock. I mean, I get it, you know, lumber mills probably were shut down because people couldn't be working in close quarters with COVID. But nevertheless, the price of lumber is up 300%, you know, or something, and, you know, which can push up the price of housing, which, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, and you see it, it's not just lumber. I mean, it goes across, in my report, you can see it, that it goes across all of the commodities. I mean, really, really big moves. And things like, one of the ones that shocked me was that the year-on-year housing prices in the United States were up 15% in one of the recent months. I mean, that didn't even happen in the housing bubble, you know, in 2007 and 8. So, I mean, that's huge. And so I describe it as a crack-up boom. You know, I think people are not stupid, and people realize that, you know, if they have savings and they have the ability to borrow, they're better off owning a house than they are putting the savings in the bank or hanging on to cash. And the reason is that house will maintain its value, but those savings aren't going to buy as much in the future. And especially when you combine that with something the government's done, which has held the interest rates down. You know, when I first bought my first house, the interest rate was like 11%. You know, now you can buy a house for 30 years at 3%. Well, if somebody told me I could buy an asset that was going to have a long duration, that was I could live in and enjoy, and it only cost me 3% in an inflationary environment, I'd say, yeah, you know, give me that. I'll do that. And thus you have all these bidding wars for houses, you know, more at the starter end than at the big end. But, you know, a lot of people are thinking, well, you know, it's smart to get a house. And so, and there hasn't been enough housing stock built since 2008, so on and so forth. So we're in, in my view, the beginning to middle innings of the demise of fiat currency. And there really is no way out. And I find it, you know, humorous the way the Fed, you know, has tried to say it's transitory and it's, you know, year-on-year base effects, and they have tools. They have lots and lots of tools, you know, and they got nothing. I mean, yeah, they have tools. They could raise interest rates, or they could withdraw, you know, liquidity to reverse QE. But when they tried that, you know, in the fall of 2008, I mean, the market tanked. And so they don't have any tools. I mean, they've got the tool they've got is they can talk a lot. But beyond that, they got nothing, because if they were to really start to withdraw liquidity, everything would collapse. They know it. And so, you know, this is what happened when, you know, Ben Bernanke, you know, way back when, you know, realized that, you know, who's an expert, so-called expert on the depression, you know, determined that the correct solution to a depressionary environment, he said, we have a tool called the printing press that means deflation can never happen. And so central bankers are deathly afraid of inflation. And, you know, but Helicopter Ben came in and said, no, don't worry about that. We got that one covered. You know, we can cover deflation by printing money. So, you know, what they didn't, you know, anticipate or talk about or address is how they handle the other one, which is when they've got too much inflation. And there was a time when that did get handled by Paul Volcker in the 70s, the last bout of inflation we had. But that solution has long since left the barn. I mean, they can't do that. If they did that, the whole world would collapse. So, you know, they've now got kind of a runaway machine that they can't really control. And my guess is what's going on is Jay Powell's just playing for time. He just wants to get out of there and dump it onto somebody else. And, you know, or at least I know if I were in his shoes, that's what I would want to do. So it's a mess. It's a real mess, Tom. It's very sad. It's very unfortunate. But, you know, no point in crying in our beer. You know, we got to just figure out how to best manage and take care of ourselves and our families, the people we love, and then try to solve it and create a better world when we come out the other side. And I'm confident that we will, but I think that there will be some severe turbulence in the next couple of years. There's already been a lot, and I think it's going to be more. So
Larry, as we're talking about the strategy of inflating the currency, you have a great chart showing the expansion of M1 money supply, and it's showing that the money supply has never grown at a rate like we've seen in the past year, as you were mentioning. So is there one factor or a handful of factors that have come that can come together to really see the inflation fire start to really burn and rise dramatically?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's got to get deep into the system, and it's got to work through every piece of the system. And it's, you know, one factor, obviously the money supply is a big piece of it. But what's also going on, I just observed this more recently, I think other people have too, is there's a real problem at the low end of the help wanted market. You know, the McDonald's in Massachusetts area are paying people to come interview. You know, don't even take a job, just come in and interview with us and we'll give you a small check. You know, we want to talk to you and convince you why working at McDonald's might be a good idea. You know, they're having a really hard time filling low-end jobs because of all the stimulus and other, you know, benefits people are getting. And so, you know, and because, you know, people who are making, you know, wage salaries are realizing that they need more to live, to survive. And so, you know, that's how it starts. I mean, you get the price of everything going up and then wages go up and it becomes, inflation becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy and a mindset amongst all the people. You know, the producers realize, oh, my inputs are going up in price, so I've got to raise my prices, or do the alternative, which is what my deli did. My deli, you know, they used to give you, you know, probably a good half inch of turkey on a turkey sandwich. And I swear it's now down to like, you know, a quarter of an inch or less. It's like a couple of slices of turkey. It's the same price. I'm like, what's going on here, guys? I mean, and that's, so that's shrinkflation, right? So, you know, the inflation just creeps into the system and then it builds and builds and builds. I mean, I was in my teens in the 70s and we saw it. I mean, gasoline was 25 cents in, you know, the 60s. And of course the oil shock kicked it off, but you know, it builds and once the psychology gets there, then everybody, you know, wage earners demand more, people selling things demand more, people who have stuff to sell demand more, homeowners demand more, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It just becomes, you know, more worse and worse. And, you know, hyperinflation is defined as 50% in a given month. I mean, obviously we're not even close to that. And I don't know if we'll get there, but we could. And, you know, we're certainly well above the stated rate of inflation the government's telling us. You and I were talking about that. I mean, the notion that we're at 1 or 2% is just a joke. You know, my healthcare goes up 15% a year. We all know that. And by the way, that also feeds into the fourth turning, because once it becomes clear to almost everybody in the government or everybody in the country that the government's just blatantly lying about everything, then what's really the legitimacy of the government? I mean, if you think of the Russian example, you know, they were like, you know, they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work, you know, which is the saying in Russia. And I think, you know, there's going to be some of that going on here. I mean, it's, you know, people are going to be bitching like crazy about inflation. The government's going to be saying there is none. Well, pretty soon people are going to just say, you know, I don't believe this government anymore. And, you know, maybe we need to throw all these guys out and go back to a gold standard. I mean, I'm obviously half joking because it's going to take a lot to get to that. But that's my dream. So.
And as you say, out of the three scenarios, that's probably the least likely is revaluing against a hard currency.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, that obviously, you picked that up from my letter. I mean, that's what we should do. I mean, the least painful way to address the issue that we presently are in is to have really enlightened government, really enlightened monetary authorities. And they would say, look, folks, we've lived beyond our means for far too long. We've got a serious debt problem here. We're going to do a restructuring of the dollar. You know, we're going to restructure it versus gold. We're going to restructure it versus Bitcoin, whatever it might be. You know, we're going to go back onto a gold standard at a much higher price. And, you know, all prices are going to adjust accordingly. And we will put ourselves back into a sound money environment and everyone can make rational business decisions. I mean, that would be, well, very painful. That would be a solution that arguably I think would be less painful than letting the currency, you know, hyperinflate or you know, continuing down this road with all the attendant problems. I mean, the biggest, most comparable country to us, it's not perfectly comparable because the debts were different and they had war and so forth, but is the German hyperinflation in the 20s, which, you know, wiped out the middle class and led to so much pain that they were willing to follow a madman who told them they were great and they could, you know, conquer the world. And so, you know, they're, you know, if we go the full-blown inflation route, you know, there's going to be a lot of pain for a lot of people. It's really going to be very sad. But, you know, I don't think the politicians that we have today, I don't think they even begin to have a clue that the underlying problem, in my opinion, the underlying problem in society today is the money's no good. I mean, my moniker on Twitter is fix the money, fix the world. And I think at an ethical level, at a financial level, you know, where we've really been done wrong, you know, we, the average people, and, you know, maybe I'm not average, but the, you know, people who work for a living, right, where we've been done wrong is, you know, with the way the financial elites and the government have taken advantage of the money. And, you know, and they've done it for their own benefit. And those who've been involved in government and know how to play the game have gotten fabulously rich. And, you know, it's come at the cost of the, you know, the honest laborer. You know, what's the quote is, there's no better way to feather the rich man's nest than to the sweat of the the rich man's soil better than the sweat of the working man, you know, through than inflation. I mean, inflation just kills the average person because they're the last to get the money, you know, whereas the people sitting at the spigot, you know, in Washington, D.C. and in, you know, financial centers, they're the first to get the money. And they know what to do with it, and they take advantage of it, and they become fabulously wealthy. I mean, that's part of the reason why we've got the wealth disparity that we have now, and that's part of the reason why middle class and lower classes are being so badly pinched. And unfortunately, most of them don't know that. Some of them think it's just evil rich people who are screwing them, and that the solution, you know, according to AOC and her ilk, is to tax the shit out of them. And you know, that's not gonna solve the fundamental problem. So.
So Larry, how does monetary velocity play into this equation as well? You have a chart in your letter showing that velocity is at one of the lowest points of all time as well. So explain to us how velocity fits into this equation.
Yeah, that's a great question. So as you know, think of velocity as, you know, economic activity. Think of velocity. Think of like a teacup, or you know, a teacup growing into a saucer. But think of somebody, velocity is like somebody spinning a spoon around to make the water move around. And if you went from a teacup to, you know, bathtub, and the spoon was spinning at the same level, and now you've got a bathtub's worth of water, well, you know, you've got so much water that the velocity is not going to go around as much with your spoon spinning it. Okay. And so, you know, they've added so much money to the system that monetary velocity by definition has plunged, because there's only so much activity to drive velocity. And they continue to do that. And historically, there have been two, there's a chart in my report that you're alluding to that shows this very nicely. Eventually, you get to a point where there's just so much money out there that, you know, velocity almost becomes zero relative to the money. And of course, at that point in time, the money is worthless. And then what happens is there's a huge inflation. And, you know, in this particular case, the last two times, you know, the velocity was this low were, you know, in the 1969-70s period, and in the 30s. And so, you know, what you had in both of those cases was just an explosion of velocity and inflation coming out of those periods, where eventually it just couldn't get any lower and a turn had to take place. And so, you know, in the case of the 30s, Roosevelt reset the dollar against the gold by 70%. So you got, you know, 10 years of inflation, you know, 70% inflation in 1 year. And in the case of the 70s, it just built up over time, you know, as they basically, you know, Johnson with guns and butter said, well, we can fight this war and have a great society both at the same time. And then of course the Arab War embargo came and really kicked it in the shins. And the next thing you know, the price of everything was going up really fast. And so velocity was really roaring. And I think, you know, we were at a very low velocity, you know, right before COVID hit. We went even lower when COVID hit. All this money got printed, and now you've got the teaspoon stirring a swimming pool. And of course, there's no velocity with all that money out there. But what's going to happen is everybody's going to change their behavior and realize, hey, this dollar isn't holding its value. I need to go and spend it before it loses all of its value. And this is what, you know, we all know as Gresham's Law, which is you know, by definition, you'll hold the currency which you know will hold its purchasing power, and you'll spend the one which you know is not going to hold its purchasing power. This has happened, you know, in hundreds of countries where they experience hyperinflation. It doesn't happen that often with the world's reserve currency. It must have happened in Rome back when the Roman Empire fell. But the point is that, you know, people are starting, and this is, we see it, it's what's called a crack-up boom, right? We start to see it in this housing stuff and elsewhere, cars. I mean, you know, and you know, it's perverse the way it all rolls through. I mean, I read yesterday that, you know, the auto manufacturers are having trouble getting supply of chips, and so they're not able to, you know, put the chips in the trucks, and the trucks are sitting at the Ford manufacturing facility waiting for the chips. And of course, that means there's a shortage of cars on the new car lots, which means somebody who wants a car has to buy a used one, which means used car prices are going up at record values, and that everyone sees that signal. And I actually did it in my case. I had a car with some pretty high mileage. I thought, well, I could put more mileage on it because I don't really need a new car. You know what? I bet a new car is going to cost a whole lot more in 2, 3, 4 years. And so I went and bought a used car. You know, I coming off somebody else's lease, a couple of years on, a good deal, you know, really cheap compared to the sticker price. And I just thought, you know, I'm gonna take advantage of this change in pricing. And I know that the car I want is going to be more in 2 or 3 years. And so, again, there's another inflationary example. My monetary velocity just went up. I bought a car I didn't really need. I could have made 2 more years out of the existing car that I had. And, you know, that's a perfect example of increased monetary velocity. I think you're seeing that kind of decision get made everywhere, you know, and so that Gresham's law piece of it just accelerates the problem. And, you know, it's low monetary velocity. I mean, it's real, and Lacey Hunt and the deflationary force. I mean, we've been in a deflationary environment for 40 years. I mean, from, you know, 1979, 80-ish. To now, interest rates have fallen. And, you know, you've got huge amounts of bonds in Europe that are trading at negative interest rates. Guess what? They can't fall anymore, right? And so everything in life is cyclical. We all know that. Nothing repeats exactly the same, but it rhymes. And so, you know, that cycle's over. And, you know, we're going to see higher rates of interest, higher inflation rates. People are going to demand them. The bond market is going to demand them, because the bond market's going to say, hey, the price of everything's going up. You want me to accept a 10-year with a 1.7 yield? That makes no sense. I mean, I'm going to lose a lot of money if I do that deal. And so the bond market, I mean, this is what I think is going to trigger the next round of problems for all of us, is the bond market's going to say, we don't like this, we're out of here, and there's not going to be a buyer. The Fed's going to say, well, we can't have higher interest rates. We know if we have higher interest rates, that's going to shut the economy down. That's not going to help with the debt to GDP problem. You know, in fact, they've been heavily signaling this, and the best source for all this information, I highly recommend people subscribe, is Luke Kroman. They've been heavily signaling that they've got to have GDP growing faster than the rate of interest significantly. And the reason for that is that they've got to get, you know, the GDP, the product, that GDP is what pays the interest on the debt, right? I mean, the top of my Twitter feed, it shows you the fundamental mathematical problem we've got here is that the debt's grown much faster than GDP. And so, you know, eventually it's the GDP which creates the profit, which leads to the ability, or the earnings that lead to the ability to pay the interest. And so if the debt keeps growing, the interest burden keeps getting bigger, eventually all your income goes to paying interest. And then the debt's no good by definition. And that's kind of where we're at. And so, you know, it's only a matter of time before everybody kind of comes to the same conclusion. I mean, I'm pretty sure, you know, I've come to that conclusion. I'm pretty sure most gold and silver people have come to that conclusion. I know most of the Bitcoin people have come to that conclusion. But if you look at it, we're still probably 10% or less of the total population. I think more people are aware of it. I mean, I see it in the people I interact with, but we're still 10% or less. Well, tipping point theory, Malcolm Gladwell, is that when 10% of the population figures something out and it crosses that and it becomes pretty obvious, then a huge piece of the population figures it out and it moves quickly in that direction. And we're right at about the 10% area in my estimation. And we're, you know, we got the car price going up, we got the house prices going up, we got, you know, it's going to get, inflation is going to be really obvious in a year, really obvious to a lot of people. And then they're going to double down on what they've been doing. They're going to work to spend everything they can. They're not going to save a dime. They're going to buy silver. They're going to buy gold. They're going to buy gold mining stocks. They're going to buy Bitcoin. All those price signals are going to tell government, uh-oh, you know, we've got an inflation problem. They're going to try and deny it, which is what they do. You know, they're going to lie through their teeth, but, and people are going to say, you guys got to cut back on the printing. And they're going to say, we can't cut back on the printing because if we don't do, everything's going to collapse. And they're right. And so, you know, then the bondholders are going to go to the Fed, and eventually what'll kill it all. And the kill shot will be when the bondholders go to the Fed and say, sold to you, Fed, take all this. There are no buyers of a 10-year. Every single person who owns a 10-year says this currency is becoming worthless. Get me out of here. Give me cash. And of course, they take that cash, by the way, and they either go buy a house, a car, food, Bitcoin, gold, silver, or gold mining stocks, right? Or maybe even regular stocks. I mean, regular stocks are not the worst choice. I mean, bonds are the worst choice, right? Because the currency is losing value. And so when that happens, it's over. It's basically over because, you know, at that point, the Fed balance sheet will be 40 billion, you know, and I'm sorry, 40 trillion. And, you know, and we'll be... Everyone will literally want out of the dollar, and, you know, there'll be dollars kicking around in the, you know, in the street, the way they're kicking around in Venezuela today, you know, the peso down there. I mean, it's just, and there'll have to be a new currency. And for, you know, some brief period of time, people will be using gold or silver coins or, you know, they'll, whatever. I mean, we don't know how the government's going to respond. Right. I mean, at some point they'll probably try, you know, a new dollar, or, you know, they've talked about doing Fed coin, which I can't imagine anyone's going to trust. But you know, there'll be something promoted and it probably won't work. And, you know, Churchill said it, right? Americans do the right thing after they've tried everything else. And eventually, somebody will say, you know, and that's why it would have been good to have Judy Shelton on the Fed. Somebody will say, you know what, we got to go back to a gold standard. You know, we need sound money. The way we got into this problem is we don't have sound money. And the way we're going to get out of this problem is to have sound money. It's really that simple. I mean, there's no great mystery here. There's a lot of mystery about how it unfolds and all the zigs and zags, tons of mystery, totally unknown. And that's why, you know, you can't, I mean, the one thing I would advise everyone who's listening to this is don't use much leverage. I mean, you got to have staying power. I mean, I was reading some stuff this morning by Jeremy Grantham, a very smart guy. And he said, you know, this is an enormous bubble. And when it bursts, everything could come down. Everything. That means gold and silver. That means gold and silver mining stocks. That means Bitcoin. That means the whole damn thing. Everybody could be literally just scrambling for liquidity. And, you know, there are things that show in the Weimar Republic where the hyperinflation eventually made the currency worthless. But even people who had it right and owned gold, you know, basically, if they were levered, you know, they got carried out. You know, so you know, debt is dangerous. It really is dangerous. And, of course, that's the exact opposite of what we've been told and we've been led to believe. You know, oh, yeah, don't worry about it. Lever up. Debt's cheap. You know, keep growing. Keep the economy going. Well, no. It's not. And so I think everybody needs to understand, you know, that they want to own sound money, you know, like solutions, and they want to own them on an unlevered basis, you know, because the leverage, you know, there could be some really extreme moves. You know, there could be another March of 2020, not driven by COVID, but just driven by the pop in the stock market bubble. I mean, and, you know, anyone who says there's not a bubble in the stock market really isn't doing their work. You know, if you do your work and you compare it to prior bubbles and you know, I mean, there's speculation going on everywhere. It's, you know, out of control. You got SPACs, you know, they thought they'd solved this whole leverage problem. And then, you know, then you've got these hedge funds that are doing equity swaps and are, you know, basically taking $8 billion and levering it up 5 to 10x. I mean, and they get a few positions that move against them and bang, you know, they're bankrupt, you know, whang. I mean, it's just, it's amazing. I mean, there's so much speculation going on. It really is. Unless financial history has been completely turned on its head, it is going to end badly. What I don't know is, will it end badly tomorrow or will it end badly in 5 years or 10 years? I don't think it's 10 years. You know, in general, fourth turnings seem to kind of occur within 20-year windows. And I marked the beginning of this one. You can either mark the beginning of this one at 2000 or at 2008. Certainly at 2008 it started. You know, so maybe it could be, you know, 20 years. So 2020, you know, 28 would be kind of when this whole thing is ending and climaxing. That seems about right to me, which means we're going to have a really interesting 6, 7, 8 years here, you know, as this kind of continues to unfold. So
Larry, as most of our listeners would have heard in the past, gold is one of the best hedges against inflation. So why is it such a sentiment-driven market, considering the fundamentals of the situation that we've been discussing here so far?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the funny thing about the gold market is that's not a free market either, okay? I mean, and I think we've had this discussion. I'm sure you've had this with other guests that you've had on. You know, the gold market is, frankly, it's manipulated. I mean, there are many banks who've confessed to manipulating it. And, you know, there's paper gold. I mean, gold, you know, obviously originally was meant to be a bearer instrument. And, you know, gold coin was a gold coin. You all knew what it was. You couldn't fake it, et cetera. Okay, fine. But, you know, it's impractical to carry a bunch of gold coins around to do business. And so, you know, everyone started, you know, having paper receipts for gold. And then, of course, that led to currencies backed by gold. Of course, then that got dissolved. But the point is that, you know, they figured out how to suppress the gold market pretty well in the past 20 or 30 years. And depending upon what statistics you look at, and it's opaque, it's hard to know, but it's pretty clear that there are hundreds of claims on every ounce of gold that really exists. So there's really a pyramid of gold claims too. And this was done to create a suppression of the gold price. I mean, Barsky and Summers in a paper outlined that, you know, called Gibson's Paradox, and they used it. Rubin and you know, Summers and a bunch of others used it to suppress the gold, you know, the gold price. And because they knew that if they had a roaring gold price, they knew that would blow up the bond market, and they needed people to be willing to hold bonds. And so, you know, as Carville said, you know, I want to be the bond market when I come back because you got all the power in the world. So, you know, the gold market's a funny market. I mean, it's been deeply, deeply suppressed. And, you know, when will that end is what probably everyone wants to know. And I do too. I'm not sure. I think, you know, I think what will end it is, you know, people saying, give me the damn gold, you know, and then it'll become clear who's swimming naked, right? I mean, you either have it or you don't. And if it's not in your possession, you know, or your safe deposit box or a depository you really trust, it's not your gold. You know, if somebody says they've sold you gold, you know, or if you have GLD, it's entirely possible that the gold underlying that ETF is not fully there. In other words, they've got commitments from others, custodians and so forth to deliver. And when gold's at $40,000 an ounce, which I think it could be, they won't deliver, you know, and they'll just cash settle you at the last price before it moved to 40. Right. I mean, and as you know, there'll be a one-time reset. And so everyone's kind of assumed a continuous market and doesn't have to be. There may not be a continuous market. I mean, if gold were suddenly overnight at $40,000, you know, my suspicion is that there will be a lot of gold claims that would not be met. And so it's, you know, it has to do with that. In the interim, what drives the prices more is just the negative, you know, interest rates and negative real interest rates. I mean, the reason that, you know, we had the correction out of 2011 to 2015 is that the real interest rate, you know, went more positive, slightly more positive during that time frame. And of course now, you know, within, you know, as everyone knows, real interest rates, you know, the rate of interest on a bond minus the inflation rate. So now with the inflation rate growing and the bond yields low, the real interest rate is getting more negative, more deeply negative. In fact, the correction off of last August saw just a very small backup in that and change in that. But that appears to be turning around now. And as these higher inflation numbers come through without higher bond yields, we're going to go deeply negative again. And, you know, the math says that we really have to go to like 5-7% deeply negative. And at that point, in that kind of environment, gold is just going to roar. And so it's not entirely a sentiment issue. It's, I guess it is, because it's what people decide to, you know, they want to hold. But it's a tricky market. And of course, that's what the Bitcoiners all, you know, focus in on and say, you know, hey, look, I mean, here's a market that can't be as easily manipulated. There are Bitcoin futures. There aren't nearly as many of them. And, you know, we've got a mathematical formula and, you know, there's no dilution in this 21 million. And so, you know, it's not suppressed. And so, you know, as Luke Roman says, I mean, Bitcoin is the one monetary fire alarm that hasn't been silenced. I mean, the gold and silver fire alarms, you know, I mean, look, we've got outrageous monetary inflation. Look at the chart in my report. I mean, it's up like 60%, you know, in the last year. It's just outrageous. I mean, gold should be at 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. It's not. You know, it's up off of a low of 1,200 or 1,300 into the 1,800s. And that's a nice move. But, you know, meanwhile, you know, Bitcoin's exploding. And that's because there's no Bitcoin suppression scheme going on. And by the way, that's also why you see, you know, Lagarde and Yellen and everybody else, you know, attacking Bitcoin and floating rumors about 80% taxes and all kinds of other bullshit. You know, they're trying to create FUD because they don't want people, the government does not want people finding the exits. I mean, they're debasing the shit out of the currency and they want us to pay for their fuck ups. And, you know, we're sitting here trying to defend ourselves and they don't want us to find the exits. You know, they want to shut the exits down. They basically said, you know, gold, no, we're not going to let you do that because we're going to print, you know, we're going to print a lot of paper gold. So you're not going to get any satisfaction there, you know, and now Bitcoin is, I mean, if I were a central banker and I saw what the Bitcoin price had done, you know, it's a substitute for fiat currency, you know, I'd be shitting my pants, right? And they probably are. And so, you know, they got to bad talk it as much as they possibly can. And they've been trying to do that and they're going to continue to do that. But I think they're going to find that it doesn't work. And so it's going to contribute to the continued loss of confidence in the monetary system that they've created and benefited from. And that's a good thing. You know, I mean, these people really deserve to have their ass handed to them, and they will. I mean, I live for the day that, you know, Ben Bernanke is in the history books right there beside John Law, you know, as one of the great monetary cranks of history who more or less helped destroy a great nation. You know, and I'm sure he doesn't feel that way about himself, but, I'm sure he's never even considered that. But I think when history looks back, I think that's what history will conclude. So it's unfortunate, but it is what it is.
So Larry, you hold Bitcoin as part of your portfolio. So yeah. Do you try to find a reason for the pullbacks when Bitcoin, as we recently saw, had a relatively large dip, or do you just hold it with long-term conviction same way you do?
I pretty much hold it with long-term conviction and not, I don't trade around. We don't trade around our position. I do prefer, if we're going to grow our position, obviously, you know, would like growing it on pullbacks. I don't know if this pullback's over or not. If it's not, and it goes a tad lower, we'll probably increase our weighting a little bit, right? You know, it's a small enough position in our fund. I mean, I am a gold and silver mining stock fund, which has always been, you know, I've done that for 12 years, got a lot of knowledge in that area. And I believe, I mean, there are those who say, well, Bitcoin's going to demonetize gold. Perhaps, I can't say for sure. But, you know, in the short to long to intermediate term, gold's not going anywhere. You know, I mean, everyone says, well, Bitcoin's going to eat its lunch. All the millennials like Bitcoin. Fine. You know, all the boomers have all the money. And boomers don't like Bitcoin, or many boomers don't like Bitcoin. So when inflation becomes blindingly obvious, which I think is what's going to happen in the next couple of years, the boomer money is going to go into gold and gold stocks. You know, some of it might go into Bitcoin. I mean, I'm a boomer and I own Bitcoin. And there are others, but I think that, you know, Bitcoin has, I mean, the gold has the, you know, the 5,000 years of history advantage and the 7 billion people intrinsically understanding its money. And Bitcoin has a technical advantage. In many ways, it's technically superior. It's a lot easier to store and to move. But, you know, there's a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and the potential for governments messing with it, and so on and so forth. I personally don't think they will succeed. And I personally think both gold and Bitcoin will win, you know, and in varying degrees. To me, it almost really doesn't matter. I think if you have sound money of any form, or you have assets of any form, you're going to make it through this difficult period much better off than the average person. But, you know, I sometimes on my Twitter feed, people want to get into debates about gold versus Bitcoin. It's like, I love them both. You know, they're both, they each have a role. I mean, gold is a little more conservative in my view. It's less volatile. The price swings aren't as large. I mean, gold, as best I know it, gold has never had an 85% drawdown against, you know, kind of the existing monetary standard. You know, well, Bitcoin's had a couple of those. So, you know, that's worth factoring into the, you know, the equation of what your weighting should be on the two. You know, I tend to lean towards the belief that ultimately, let me get rid of this call. I tend to lean towards the belief that ultimately Bitcoin will demonetize gold, but I think that's a much longer term thing than most people who are pro Bitcoin are thinking about. I could be wrong on that though. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
So Larry, what are some of your most favorable ways to invest capital to account for all of the fundamental factors that we've been talking about when it comes to gold and gold equities? How do you split the fund between producers, developers, and drill stories?
Great question. So first off, you know, you shouldn't even be in a fund unless you can handle the risk and the volatility of a fund, right? I mean, I've had 30% drawdowns on a month or a quarter. So this is, you know, this is risk equity. So let's just start there. And gold mining stocks, by the way, are risk equity. So, you know, we're talking about a very big monetary change that's going to hurt a lot of people. And the first thing I tell anybody who's looking to invest in my fund is don't even invest in my fund unless you have a lot of gold and silver coins. I mean, you just want to have pure money that's safe, right? Because, you know, it's not going anywhere. So you start there and then you think, all right, I mean, it's, you know, and to me that might be, you know, remember they used to say the old bond allocation, which you took your age minus 100 or whatever, you know, and you said, okay, I'm 60, then I got to have 60% bonds and 40% equities or something. You know, well, to me, gold coins are bonds, right? They've gone up. It actually works out too. They've gone up about 8% a year since 2000. So, you know, you start off and you have a lot of your money in gold coins or silver coins, okay, because that's safe money. It won't disappear. Okay, that's fine. Now you decide you want to do some equity speculating, fine. And that really is what it is, because these companies are, you know, they've got risk, okay, but they can also provide reward. And you've got the three areas, as you pointed out. You've got producers, developers, drill stories. Probably I tend towards the developers, probably the hardest ones to figure out. So if you're an amateur, I wouldn't even start to mess with the developers. The reason is There's a lot of ways for things to go wrong between the time when a deposit is a deposit, when it becomes a mine. So you've got to get a permit, you've got to build it, you've got to finance it, you got to not screw up the environment. I mean, there's just a million things. So you can almost, if you're just trying to do this simply, throw away the developers. Don't go there. The drill stories, the trick there is to find good people, good geology, and find them at low valuations. And then recognize that they're not all going to work. You don't take too big a position in any one of them. But when you do hit it right, they become 5 to 10 extra money. And that's a good thing, obviously. And the safest place to be are the producers. And you know, you can start with the biggest names, and they're great, like Barrick and Newmont. The problem with those names is they don't grow. They got 5 million ounces, they're mining the deposits, they're gonna run out of gold someday. They gotta find new gold. They're not growing, and they're fully valued because they're the go-to names for the big institutions. So, you know, they're trading at 10 times cash flow. At the super small end, you got the little producers that are risky, maybe have one mine and are growing. And if they're too small, you know, they can get in trouble too, because if anything goes wrong with that mine, then you got a problem. So the best place in my view to be is what I call the mid-size emerging producers, which are the medium to small size companies, generally market caps of 100 to 700 million, generally one or two mines operating, maybe more, and, you know, profitable. They've already, you know, they've got a good structure in their operations, and, you know, they're going to try and add capacity. And sometimes, you know, companies that are 200, 300, 400 million, they're not big enough to have gotten into the GDXJ yet, but at some point they might as they grow. And so you buy them, you know, and often you're paying, you know, 3-4 times cash flow for them. And, you know, like, I mean, or less. I mean, there's one that's in Mongolia called Steppe Gold that's, you know, trading at a couple times cash flow right now. And, you know, they're going to grow that mine. They're going to grow additional deposits they've got, and it's going to get bigger. It's going to get into the GDXJ, and it's going to be a multi-bagger from here, in my opinion. So, you know, you find these companies when they're low multiple and the production is growing, and you got three ways to make money. In any gold stock, you know, there are three things that will make a gold stock go higher. If it's a producer, well, one thing that'll make all gold stocks go higher is higher price of gold, right? Okay, higher price of gold, all gold stocks go up. Okay, if you're in a producer, the two other things will make you go higher. You'll produce more, so you're producing 100,000 ounces, but you've got a capacity expansion, now you're at 150. Or you got your second mine going, now you're at 200, okay? So your production grows. The second thing that'll make you go higher is you bought it at 3 times cash flow, but it's getting bigger, better known, the story's good, management's trusted, trades at 6 times cash flow. So nothing else changed, and you doubled your money because you got a low multiple expanding to a high multiple, okay? So, you know, that's really what you're looking for, in my view, are these emerging small producers that have the ability to grow. And, you know, they have a development story component to them often, because they usually have one mine that's working and they're building another one. But if they built the first one successfully and the other one pencils out, and, you know, you can kind of figure out where they're going and so forth. So, yeah, that's the area I like. And that's where most of my fund is. But I do mess with the other areas. And the other thing is that kind of depends on where you, a little bit, it depends on where you are in the cycle. The drill stories were a great buy 2 years ago. And I bought a ton of drill stories for just pennies on the dollar. I mean, companies that had, you know, 1 million ounces in the ground, they were selling for a $7 million valuation. It's $7 an ounce of gold in the ground. I mean, that's just nuts, right? You know, that doesn't exist right now. I mean, that's, you know, you're paying 30 an ounce in the ground today. So, you know, that easy money is gone. But, you know, there's still very high quality producers that are selling at 3 times cash flow. You know, I've got a portfolio full of them, and that's 3 times cash flow at 1750 gold. You know, and as most people watch this probably understand, there's a lot of operating leverage in this game, right? If your ASIC is 1,000, and so at 1750 gold, you make 750. You know, take your gold price to 2500. Well, you know, you just doubled your profits. You added another 750 of profits onto the thing. So, you know, that's a nice place to be. And there are a lot of companies out there that fit that model, and that's where I try to be. And that's the other thing I would say to gold investors: you got to diversify, because, you know, and you got to look at each of these things objectively. You know, people tend to fall in love with some of these names, and there are really high quality stories. Like Wesdome is a good example. Wesdome was a super high quality story the last 6-7 years. I owned it. I ran, but it got overvalued. I mean, they you know, everybody chases the winners, and it just got nutty. I mean, it got to the point where it was trading. And of course, then it fell 50%, and now I'm buying Wesdome again. It's still a good company. It just wasn't worth the price it got to. So you got to be kind of looking at, you know, what am I paying? What am I getting? You know, where are we in the cycle? And, you know, when everybody's in love with something, it's time to kind of leave that party and then go find some other party where, you know, it's a pretty good situation, but nobody's discovered it yet. And that's how you kind of, you know, maximize your returns and picking these names.
So Larry, do you look at any other asset classes like silver miners or maybe uranium plays, or just stick to?
I should have used the word gold and silver. So I definitely do silver. So, you know, I'm a monetary debasement fund, right? I mean, the whole notion here is I'm trying to sell my investors on there's going to be inflation. The money is going to be debased. You want to be protected from that. I've got what I believe is the best way to do that. It's a combination of gold, silver miners and so forth, with a little bit of Bitcoin on the side for the upside optionality. I've never messed with uranium. I know it's probably a very good place to be right now from the supply demand point of view, but I only have so much bandwidth. It's all I can do to figure out all these little companies. So uranium's off the table, but yes, silver's great. And it's hard to say. I'd say I'm probably 30 or 40% silver miners. I mean, there aren't very many primary silver mines. Most mine a little bit of both. And a lot of the silver that gets mined comes as a byproduct of some other bigger copper mine or something. But yeah, silver's great. And it's the same kind of story. It's, you know, it's gold on steroids in terms of price movements. It's more volatile, but you know, it also has the benefit of it. There's not a large stockpile of it, and it's getting used and more increasingly used in electric vehicles and solar panels. So yeah, there's a lot of benefit to being in silver as well. And I've got a pretty high weighting there. It's hard. It's hard to find good silver miners. There just aren't as many of them as there are gold miners. So.
Excellent. Larry, do you have anything you'd like to leave our audience with as we wrap up?
No, not really. I mean, I hope everyone's able to prosper. And all I would really say is just be careful out there. I think we're going into a pretty tumultuous period. And so I would really be careful with leverage. I think, you know, nobody really gets carried out in the investment business unless you get over levered. And we're seeing some of that. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And, you know, and if you're going to be in the gold stocks or even in gold and silver, you know, you got to be prepared for, you know, price movements that shock you both on the downside and the upside, you know, and, it's going to be bumpy, in my opinion. It's going to be really, really bumpy. And so you got to have a strong hand on the tiller. You got to recognize, I mean, look, I bought stocks and had them go down 50%. And if nothing's changed in the story, I double down almost every time. But you know, a lot of people don't feel that way. I mean, I've had other people invest with me and, you know, I'll go down 10 or 20%. Like, I can't handle this. I'm out. Like, I get it, you know, but recognize what you're doing when you're in these games. I mean, there's a lot of asymmetry in this stuff, you know, and I've always looked at this as you can only lose 1x and you can make multiples. And that's what you should be looking at when you're looking at investing in gold and silver mining companies. You know, you can lose every dollar you put up. These things can go to zero, and some of them do. But, you know, and if you're playing to make 2x your money, well, that's not a good bet. I mean, it's just not a good enough bet. But if you know what you're doing in terms of what you're buying and what it should be worth, then, you know, you're looking at, if you're right, you're going to make 2 to 5x. And if you're wrong, you're going to lose 1x. And if you can be more than half right on that math, you're going to do great. So, you know, but understand that those are tough numbers for people who haven't been in the space to accept. And, you know, I see a lot of new people coming to the space. Say, well, what gold stock should I buy? What should I do? And I'm just, all I can say, having done this for 12 years, is it's tough. This is really, really tough. You know, I mean, I would try to stick to some of the bigger emerging producers. You'll do fine. I mean, a big holding that I love is Endeavor. You know, another one that I like is Equinox. Another one in the bigger names, another one I like is Kinross. You know, I don't like Barrick and Newmont just because they're so damn big. You know, I mean, I think these are all, you know, multi-mined, well-managed, big producers that should, you know, do as well, if not better, probably better than the GDXJ or the GDX indices. And so that's where I would kind of stay. I mean, these are your good, solid companies. I mean, they're not going to be 10 baggers like these little, unless gold goes to 50,000, like these little companies I'm in, but you're not going to lose your money either. They're solid. Mm-hmm. And so I would stick in that area if you're new to the space. And then when you're speculating, you know, just be prepared that you could, every dollar you put in a speculative situation, you could lose it, every single dollar. And so don't ever get in, you know, don't ever hear some great little story and think to yourself, oh, I'm going to pile into this because I'm going to make a killing. You know, just size every bet according to the fact that I could be wrong, I could lose it. If it's a small bet, no big deal. And if it's, you know, if it works and it's 10x your money, you're going to feel great, even if the amount was small. So that would be my advice to people looking at the area. So
some sound ideas there. Larry, of course, we can find you at Lawrence Lepard on Twitter, and also your new revamped website, which is has all of your quarterly letters, which I encourage people to give a browse. They're packed with excellent information. All of that's available at ema2.com. Larry, thanks.
Oh, thank you very much, Tom. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for letting me be so long-winded. I hope people take some benefit out of it. I'd like to see people who understand and believe in sound money do well. And I think we're going to see a lot of that. So to those who are nervous about this area, I just say, stay the course. We're going to be rewarded here in the next 5 years in a big way, in my opinion.
Excellent advice. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you very much, Tom. Really enjoyed it.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.